Save big money on your bathroom update at Menards. Transform your bathroom with a stunning new vanity from Magic Woods. With over 100 options to choose from, our vanities combine contemporary style with durable materials. Find the ideal piece to create the bathroom you've always wanted. From stylish and elegant to simple and modern, save big money on Magic Woods vanities at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all our great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
The British driver sees the checkered flag first. Lando Norris wins the Australian Grand Prix.
Beautifully handled. Amazing way to start the year. Thank you so much.
The new championship leader in Formula One, Oscar Piastri, wins the Saudi Grand Prix.
Got a lot of fun to have this year.
World champions last year and still the team to beat in 2025. With both drivers fighting for the title. Are McLaren exactly where they need to be right now?
The journey never stops. Wherever we are, we're always pushing the boundaries. Raising the bar is part of this sport. So we challenge ourselves each and every day to make sure we are never resting on our laurels. We're humble, never complacent, but always asking what the next step can be.
Piers Thin is McLaren's chief operating officer, which means he runs the factory back in Woking. It's a huge responsibility, which means he's been an integral part of the team's recent success. Piers has been with McLaren in various leadership roles since 2008, and here on F1 Beyond the Grid, with me, Tom Clarkson, he explains how the team has been transformed into world beaters. He also talks about why their mantra of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable is so effective, and he describes the impact that Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri have had on the whole team. Piers also talks about how McLaren are preparing for next year's regulation change while simultaneously fighting for both championships in 2025. He talks about what lessons he took from his time in the army while serving in Iraq, and how his dad played a big part in an F1 legend becoming a world champion.
My father was extremely influential in getting Mansell back to the car for the 1992 season. And that was very much part of dinner time conversations to engineer that switch. And what a cool outcome that happened at the end of that season.
Piers, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good time to be coming to races as well, because McLaren are flying. And I'm guessing that makes this a very sweet period for someone like you, because McLaren haven't always won during your period at the team. How different is the atmosphere now compared to, let's say, 5 years ago?
I think the journey that the team is on is extremely positive. I've been with the team a long time. And I think through the time that I've been with the team, the culture has ebbed and flowed. But one of the things that both Andrea and Zach are extremely straight talking on is our collaborative nature, our performance focus, being really, really open about our culture is laser sharp. How we run the team, how we are as the flattest structure possible, ensuring that everyone's focus everywhere is to deliver to the highest standards that we possibly can, means that we are adding performance to the car all the time, and we are never letting the bar be okay where it is, because as you can see at the sharp end of Formula One, it's extremely close. It was extremely enjoyable securing the Constructors' Championship last year, but at no time is anybody resting on their laurels. We are raising the bar in all areas.
Piers, you are the first chief operating officer we've had on the show, and you talk about flat structures. Look, for people listening who don't know what that means, can you just explain, A, what your job entails and how the flat structure of McLaren might be different to another team?
So as COO, I have direct responsibility for all of production and all of operations, but I support the team across all functions through aero, technical, performance, operations, manufacture, and logistics.
Hang on, that's a massive job list, right? In short, do you run the factory?
So I am responsible for running the factory. I'm the leader on the ground, supporting all functions, while Andrea is away racing. The flat structure that you specifically asked about is really, really important, because we have a culture that's based on empowerment. We have a culture that's extremely focused on delivering performance to the car. And I think my role is an enabler to that and supporting decisions to be made as quickly as they can be, to mean that we're driving performance through the team and decision-making is as unbureaucratic as possible. Traditional organisations might have a very organised, triangular-style hierarchy. It's not like this where we work. And it's important that it's the right group of people, the right information, and decisions are made on a rapid turnaround to focus on delivering performance to the track.
So if Andrea Stella as team principal is top of the tree, below him, how many people are at the same level feeding into him, if you like?
So the technical directors and I collaborate as a group of people, ensuring that we've got the right focus in the right areas, the right resource, the right prioritisation, to mean that we're unlocking, upgrading the current car and looking forward to the next year's car.
Do you subscribe to, it's a wonderful quote from Andrea, when he says, to win in Formula One, you have to feel comfortable being uncomfortable. Can you relate to that?
Extremely. That uncomfortableness is not only felt with the stress and pressure of a race weekend, it's felt throughout every day, every shift, day and night in a Formula One team, because doing what we achieve as a technical and factory-based organisation to get everything here is extremely challenging. And often we stress test that system with significant packages of work. That means that everyone across the whole sphere of influence has to up their game to the highest level. And certainly we push time limits to be as tight as they possibly can. And some people go, I'm not sure we can achieve that. But it's only by asking people to live right on the periphery of their comfort zone or a little bit beyond it that you really, really test how great our people are. There were multiple examples last year where we took upgrade packages that were beyond the scope of we've ever done before and delivered them in a faster turnaround to good quality and delivered them to races. That was really key, unlocking increased point scoring opportunities for both drivers.
How do you do that? Because I'm assuming prior to that, you were turning around parts as fast as possible. So how do you get that extra 10-15% from your workforce?
I think by sharing the context of the upgrade is worth X. If you do standard or best ever lead times, it'll arrive at that event. How could we get it to the event earlier? By sharing time equally through all of the areas of the team, you can ask everyone to just go that little bit further, and it comes from aero into design, and you unlock concurrent activity to mean that no tasks run in series. People are extremely creative if you just give them that additional challenge.
And I guess it helps when you're winning, right?
The challenges that people feel through the execution of the project often pales away to nothing when you go and put the car on pole or you get both cars on the podium. So it's important that the context is shared, because then people go, I understand why I did that and the difference it made. You've then got 1,000 people back at MTC hugely energised.
Can we talk a little bit more about culture, in that I'm fascinated that in 2017, the team finished ninth in the Constructors' Championship. It was a very difficult period. It was almost difficult to come and visit the MTC because you just knew that there was more potential there in the team. How many of the people that were there then are at the team now, just in percentage terms?
I don't think I could quote precise numbers. There are a lot of people who have lived through that period of the team. But I think what's fantastic is by some key strategic leadership tuning and some changes in approach, we've been able to unlock that potential that was there, both in our technical and operational and manufacturing departments. And I think that freedom and empowerment has shown that the team is just on a really positive trajectory.
With your flat structure, how do you avoid bureaucracy? Because how many people are feeding into Andrea, and how do you stop people disagreeing and taking up too much time at the discussion phase?
Andrea talks to everybody in the team. He's a hugely unique and talented individual that makes time to talk to everybody. The main technical inputters are obviously the senior management team on the racing team and the technical directors and myself. I think one of the things that's important is we don't spend time talking about things that aren't going to add value to the car. We don't create noise in each other's lives. We have conversations about the right areas at the right time to mean that we are always going, the potential in aero is this, we could do that, and therefore we've got some time, a window to make that decision, which will make that upgrade land there. Or looking ahead to next year, what the 2026 car is telling us in the tunnel that will allow the layout of the car to be fixed to deliver a car the best it can be to winter testing in 2026. So the conversations are focused. Yes, we have debates. Yes, we have differences of opinion. But the answer is what's always right for the team and for the car.
Would you consider yourself to be a big picture person or a detail person?
I think as my role has evolved in McLaren, I loved the detail. I have a great group of people around me who encourage me and nudge me or poke me on occasions to go, Piers, the detail is done by others. You're a strategic enabler. I'm very, very lucky because of my experience. I understand a huge amount of context of the detail across the whole team. But I leave the detail to others, but I'm there for support when needed.
What is your biggest day-to-day challenge, would you say?
Keeping the team flowing and at the right pace, because obviously we've got timelines of a race calendar and timelines into 2026. Encouraging through good conversations, asking questions and having conversations in all areas of the team on a day-to-day basis.
Let's talk about 26 then. So you're leading the World Championship now. How do you decide when and what bits to switch over to 2026?
Excellent question. It's a really tough one to call. There are natural durations of research that you need to do for 2026 now that the regulations are firm. And we've got those penned into our program running into next year. What we don't have is rigidity in that plan, because what's really important is we're being extremely agile with the performance that we find for this year's car to make sure we're not trading between the programs. We want the most performance in both of those swim lanes. So you can't have rigidity. You've got to have agility to be able to trade on a 24-hour basis to go, I'm swinging it more one way or more the other. And at the moment, we've got lots of performance coming for this year's car, and that will be harvested when it will make the most difference. But naturally, we do have a point in time where you have to swing some or most of the organization over to next year's car, because a regulation change not only affects the car, but it affects the setup equipment, and obviously with a new PU, extensive software changes as well. And all of that has known durations to prove it out ahead of winter testing next year.
So switching resource isn't fixed. It's like from week to week, it will ebb and flow between 26 and 25.
We take a completely flexible approach, because if we're finding performance to add to this year's car, we will take that.
And do you have to commit to 2025? Because there are so many unknowns in 26 that if there's the opportunity to win the World Championship, you just have to go for it.
Absolutely.
And then when you're looking at 26, what items have the longest lead times? What's fixed in the diary?
So it's a trade on longest lead time to design and make. and longest lead times that will add the most performance. So naturally, there are some trades between the structural elements of the car and the aerodynamic elements, and we kind of split those into two. So where we can commit to structural elements that will add less performance, we may choose to do those earlier, and we'll leave all aspects of aero exploitation as late as it possibly can be.
I love the word exploitation. That's only aero exploitation, or do you use the word exploitation when you're talking about the whole car?
There are obviously, there's a huge focus in aero exploitation, but there are the aspects of how we can set the car up, ride height and geometries also, there is tunability in that. So exploitation can cover all aspects of mechanical setup and aero.
Piers, you have to know every department at McLaren. That is what is coming across in this conversation.
Yes. It's important that I know just enough to be dangerous and have great relationships across the whole team.
And you're a design engineer by trade. That's what you studied at uni. When was the last time that you actually designed something?
Well, I made a decision quite early on in my career, having been a design engineer at a road car and sports car company, that I wasn't, A, very good at it, and I wanted to pivot into something else. And that's an important thing, to have good advice around you to go, are you enjoying what you're doing, or do you want to kind of adjust your trajectory? And I was very lucky to have good people around me that helped me make that decision. And I pivoted to be more manufacturing and operations focused and kind of found my sweet spot.
This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low-impact motion. And I don't need to second-guess my progress, because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID. This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low-impact motion. And I don't need to second-guess my progress, because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID. So, you're a man manager, and I wanted to ask next about what your greatest influences have been to sort of create the Piers Thin that we have today. Do you go back to your time in the army? Is that where the early influences occurred?
I think I kind of walk through life and go, there are snippets everywhere. Extremely strong family around me, extremely strong group of friends. I've definitely taken influence from my time in the military. I have taken influences from my involvement in what I kind of do in my spare time. I think there are lots of good aspects that I've taken from many, many threads. And I think one of the things that's really, really important when you do the kind of role that I do is listen, because the quantity of talent inside a Formula One team is everybody. Everyone's opinion, everyone's experience, everyone's tenure massively can tune what we're able to do as a team. And it's by getting all of that 1,000 people aligned that the horsepower of the team goes up a little bit, and energizing that whenever we've got big projects by good conversations in any department kind of makes me tick, makes me feel like I've had a good day.
Are there parallels between the military and a Formula One team?
Definitely. And I think when I left the military and joined Formula One, I think the communication process, the time management when you've got a closing deadline where you've got to communicate or you've got to commit to something, be that a project or a race event playing out, there's lots of parallels there. And it's great that we occasionally benchmark ourselves against military organisations, because we can always learn a lot. The military is extremely agile, as is our Formula One team, and understanding and benchmarking how they are evolving as well as the team is something that we do regularly.
So you train with the military, is that what?
We have some partnerships with organisations where we benchmark, what are you doing and what have you learnt? What are we doing? So we share ideas, because it's really important that you're looking outside of yourself, because it's very easy to go, the Formula One bubble is what it is. But actually, you need to be quite outward thinking and visionary by going, what other organisations, be that military or other high performing things, where you can go, let's go and have a conversation with them. How do they communicate? How do they understand the weather, for example, which was topical around race one of this year, to make sure they're exploiting to have the best outcome for whatever their chosen field of business is.
So these are conversations, these are ideologies, rather than doing what Red Bull do. I mean, Red Bull send their pit crew to go and train with the Royal Marines on Dartmoor in the southwest of England. Does McLaren do similar things to that?
We have lots of strategic relationships with organisations where we look to learn collaboratively from each other. I've been on Dartmoor. It's not the jolliest of places. I think we would learn more from having a good conversation sat around a table.
One thing you did in the military is you served in Iraq, a period of high stress for you, I'm sure. Were there things that you learnt in Iraq that are applicable today in Formula One?
I think my period of time in the military, I learnt a lot, certainly when I was deployed on operations. That time for that country was a period of huge instability and division inside the country. Being deployed on the ground, it was many, many extremely stressful situations. But dealing with general public, members of their military, members of their police or security services, again, listening and understanding the context of what you're actually facing, I think there are huge parallels with Formula One. And certainly, I think I honed my listening skills, my prioritization skills, my communication skills in my active service. And certainly, I'm very, very proud that I was able to take all of my soldiers there and bring all of them home, because in a number of cases, we were able to diffuse situations just by good conversation.
And is diplomacy important today in what you do at McLaren?
I think good conversations, whatever the topic, whether it's a people, process, manufacturing issue, it's important that you understand everyone's perspective. We often have things that go wrong in the team. But when things go wrong, it's important that the culture is to talk about it, involve any individuals that may have been at the coalface when the issue occurred, to go, how do we help it not happen again? And that can be a performance issue, a health and safety issue, or any specific topic. But the no blame culture is immensely important, because in a high performing team, people need to be comfortable that things can go wrong, because you get a huge amount of learning and opportunity that comes from it. And we can then put that energy into the future to make sure things don't happen again, but we continue to learn every single day.
Was the army always a short-term commission for you, or was the objective always to stay in there, or was the objective always to get involved in Formula One? What were you thinking as a younger man?
Younger man. You've now made me feel really old. I was always interested in the military. Throughout my schooling, I loved the concept of being an army officer, and I'm really, really proud of what I achieved doing that.
What aspect of that appealed so much?
Challenging situations, working with like-minded groups of people, the physical and mental aspects of that as a job really, really appealed to me. I think it was a great period of my life, but the challenge that was going on in the world of the evolution to the Iraq conflict and then into Afghanistan, I kept both routes open, and I was really, really excited to have the opportunity to take an engineering path where I could take all of my learnings from being an army officer down the path of engineering, which then led into Formula One in time. My now wife is extremely glad that I chose that pivot at that time. And my parents were as well. I had a really, really exciting chapter, but it was just time to close that chapter and move on to a career in engineering and motorsport.
Piers, you mentioned your parents. Your dad, Sheridan, was a stalwart of the Williams Formula One team, wasn't he? Commercial director there for nearly 15 years. How much did he influence your career choice?
He was always extremely supportive of whatever I wanted to do that I was extremely passionate about. He was a great person to bounce ideas off. I think he would be extremely proud of what I've achieved in my time in motorsport. And I think certainly many, many people in Abu Dhabi last year came to talk to me to say, your dad would be extremely proud of what you and the team have achieved, which really meant a lot. He was always focused on what he was extremely good at and was really, really comfortable to be, I'm here for the commercial space in his career in Formula One. And I think that tactic I've really, really taken in my own life to go, I'm really good at some things and I'm also really comfortable to say what I'm less good at. And I think being comfortable in your own skin to know where you can add value is something that I'm proud. I try and strike the right balance on a day-to-day basis.
Finding your sweet spot. When Dad was working at Williams, how much did you get exposed to Formula One? Was it any holiday jobs in Didcot, or were you going to the British Grand Prix and hanging out with Nigel Mansell? What are your earliest memories of the sport?
Before merch was even a thing, I definitely had merch in the late 80s and into the 90s. I definitely went to Didcot on a number of occasions. And obviously, my father was extremely influential in getting Mansell back to the car for the 1992 season. And that was very much part of dinner time conversations to engineer that switch. And what a cool outcome that happened at the end of that season.
Is it true that Dad left the team because of the way Mansell was treated at the end of 92? And if Mansell's leaving, I'm leaving?
I think one of the things that I'm proud of is that the balance of integrity is a hugely important thing as part of a human being. And the decisions that he made were based on the inputs that happened at that time. What's exactly the same now is there are some pretty cutthroat decisions that are made that are the right answer for the team. And there was a balance of choice there that could have gone one way or the other. The team chose one way, and the driver was kind of left to make a decision. And my father enjoyed a period in IndyCar after that.
Just out of interest, if it had been Prost and Mansell together in 93, who do you think would have won?
A huge technology change happened on the car, which meant that it was a bit of a reset of the playing field. I think it had been quite 50-50.
What did Dad make of you joining McLaren, the arch rivals of Williams? Was he happy with that, relaxed about that?
He was. We spoke about it at length, and I remember the conversation going, which team would you like to join and why, was a question he put to me. And I was like, I was kind of hoping for some advice, not a challenging question. And I love the history of the sport. I love the fact that there are a number of teams that have got huge tenure, huge legacy, multiple periods of domination. I will always have a great soft spot for Williams, and I think it's great to see them climbing the grid. But the period of multiple seasons of domination, fantastic drivers that we have inside the McLaren team, was a real draw, because it's not something that's been there for a few seasons or a decade or two. And it was a fantastic honour to support the team to celebrate their 60th anniversary 2 years ago. That was a real draw, the legacy of both drivers, engineering and dominance from multiple decades.
Another of your roles, if you're not busy enough already, is the heritage department, isn't it?
It is. A couple of years ago, Zach asked me to look into how we can support that area of the team in the best way. And it was in sync with us setting up a TPC team, so testing of previous cars. And that area of the team sits outside of the cost cap. So we structure and lay out that area of the team to have common process with what happens inside the Formula One division. We run a two-year-old car for testing purposes of drivers, engineers and mechanics. And that's a program that's been in play for a number of years. But also there is a car crew that looks after the running of all of our car collection. And in addition to that, we support a number of customers who have our cars to run them whenever they wish to. So my initial support was to get the function aligned to Formula One. And I now have a fantastic team that run it on a day-to-day basis. I'm involved strategically for certain events, and the 60th anniversary at Goodwood was definitely one of those. It's brilliant. And probably every night that I leave, I go out via our heritage team, because just being around those cars, seeing our legacy every single day, I definitely draw inspiration from.
How many cars are what you might call runners? How many of the old cars have engines in and could turn a lap?
So the collection is just under 100 cars, and about 75 to 80% of them are full runners.
That's extraordinary. And which of those cars are requested most for events like Goodwood and other festivals?
The challenge that we have is a lot of them have extremely high provenance. So therefore, a lot of them are asked a lot of the time. And we support wherever we can, because it's really important that we're showcasing our legacy, any opportunity that's right for the team. We've got cars of dominance from multiple seasons and multiple decades, and we celebrate that as often as we can. The anniversary event at Goodwood, where we celebrated our 60th anniversary, we took 14 cars from the factory. And actually, I think there was no one left at the factory, because they were all at Goodwood making sure that that event happened.
And do former engine suppliers support you with that? So all of the Honda-powered cars, are Honda in Japan turning over the engines for you, giving you new bits if you need them?
So we have a great relationship with a number of providers. It's important that you have the right engine relationship across the suite of cars. We have a great relationship with Honda Heritage. We've got a great relationship with Mercedes. We've got a great relationship with a number of engine providers or tuners that supported the cars in period. We also have a huge draw of creativity inside our heritage department. because keeping those cars alive when code computers was an emerging technology is a bit of a fine art. So it's important that we're able to modernize those electronics where we need to. And occasionally we have to make the right decision to keep that engine alive, running safely. So on certain cars, we have taken the decision to take the impaired electronics off the car and run it on a modern ECU. And when the engines are essentially irreplaceable, that allows me to sleep at night because there's lots of sensors and control that you can have that will allow that engine to run safely.
Have you got a favourite car from the Heritage Collection?
I have a number of favourites. I think our M23 chassis number 5 that Emerson won our first World Championship is absolutely up in my top three. I think all of the cars that Ayrton drove throughout the period also are right up there. But also the car from last year, which is will come into our heritage fleet soon, also is in the top three.
Compies, don't sit on the fence. Is there one favourite?
I think the M23 is a really, really unique project because it ran for a number of seasons and had such dominance. I think that's a fantastic design. And it's great that Gordon Coppock's design of that chassis was able to also influence the IndyCar also, which won in similar period. And there's lots of engineering crossover between those two cars.
Have you driven any of them?
I have.
Aha.
So over the last 12 to 18 months, we've moved our heritage team from an external building back into the MTC. And that was always part of the strategy to make them be front and centre to celebrate that legacy each and every day. And while we were moving the team, I pulled back a dust sheet and found, like you do, an M23 chassis. And I said to the guys, this is an M23 chassis. We've got any parts that go with this? And we found most of a car. I then looked at our engine register and was able to find all of the components to build an in-period 1974 spec DFV. So we created a project which is really close to my heart, where we asked our apprentices in our composite team and in our machining function to manufacture the parts that we didn't have so that they were involved in linking their engineering training with the legacy of a car from the past, and obviously a car that won our first World Championship. So that car now exists, and we've done a number of things with it, and it'll be at Goodwood this coming year to celebrate our engineering legacy and also our value that we put into the next generation. So I've driven M23 chassis 15, which is a new M23, and I've also driven M23 chassis 5. So in terms of cool points, I've driven a Formula One car, and I've driven a Formula One car that's won a World Championship, which is a proper pinch me moment.
Where do you drive them?
So we regularly test at airfields and also at Pembrey in Wales.
And chassis 5, was that what's the history of that?
So that won multiple races, but that was the chassis that Emerson won and secured enough points to win the championship in Brazil.
You're a bit of a driver yourself anyway, aren't you? You've always done a lot of hill climbing.
Still do. I guess I'm probably a bit of a frustrated mechanic, fabricator. I love spending time in my garage at home. And when I'm not at work, I'm often tinkering with something. I've hill climbed for a number of years. And in the last couple of years have taken up historic touring car racing when I can find time in and amongst work and family life.
So, Mini Cooper S, is that hill climbing or is that circuit racing?
Both.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I have my own chassis that I use for hill climbing, and I'm very, very lucky to have a great relationship with a guy who is an extremely accomplished mini racer, a guy called Aaron Smith, who helps and coaches me in a works car that's linked to an engine builder. So very, very lucky to be growing in experience in that.
And did I read that you've hill climbed a Dallara F3 car as well?
Yes.
That's properly quick, right?
In 2004, when I was in Iraq, my project that I researched, planned, and then delivered when I got home was to step from a space frame hill climb car into a proper car with a proper tub. So I built, when I got home, a Formula 3 car that I bought as a rolling kit of parts. It had an Opel touring car engine, and I had various support and advice from the hill climbing community and from Gould Engineering on the aero setup, and it was a fantastic car. It's still being hill climbed now, and hill climbing is an extremely unique part of motorsport. Extremely competent and experienced drivers threading fast cars up very, very narrow tracks, but also very, very innovative engineering. And if you look at a top level Formula hill climb car now, it has a lot of parallels to a Formula One car.
Do you have a favourite hill climb?
I do. I started at Gersten Down near Salisbury, and I've got a huge amount of friends and great memories from there. But there is nothing better than a day at Shelsey Walsh, when you can look back and feel the ambience, the history of those sheds, and you can see visions of pre-war cars and ERAs and BRMs from pre-war era. That's a very, very special place.
Do you bump into quite a few Formula One people at these hill climbs? I remember years ago going to Lowton Park with Willem Towett, the aerodynamicist. I think at the time he was at Sauber. Absolutely passionate. And he just said, come along. So I went along for the day, and it felt like my Formula Ford days back at Autosport. It was a wonderful experience.
So yes, there are a number of people from the Formula One community that do it. There are lots of also people from the motorsport community, be that suppliers or machinists or composite companies, that are involved in certain ways. And I think there's certainly been DNA that's evolved to take Formula One DNA to update the level of technology that's used in the cars now. And that's seen times tumble. And it's just a fantastic and very, very friendly and open community.
You get the Barbie out in the evening and
yeah,
all of the above, and the family comes with you.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned the TPC program. Am I right in thinking that that's been reduced this year, or are you a regulatory point
of view? There is certain regulations in what you're allowed to do within the TPC world, and that's both on engines, tyres, and the amount of time that drivers are allocated to it. It's a really, really important program where we can learn and train the next generation. So it's not only for our current race drivers, but also our simulator drivers, and some aspects of our driver development community use that as a platform for training. Because a current Formula One season is 24 races, and allowing people to move from a TPC community into a factory car build and then into the race team, it's important that we grow a competence ladder to allow a real training model to be evolved through the team.
Is that because, looking ahead, you think we're going to have to start rotating race team staff, and so therefore you're needing to train up new people to come and take on half a dozen races?
I think it's extremely important that you're always training the next generation and making sure across every function no single points of failure exist. But I think as the racing season has evolved, 24 races, the level of resilience that you need to do that is extremely high. And we do offer opportunities for the team to step out for periods or occasions where they may need to. You've got to have a live subs bench, because if someone gets injured or is unwell, we can't let the team take a step back in performance. So our live subs bench and our forward-thinking approach is aligning behind maintaining the best standards that we can inside the Formula One team.
But injury aside, you guys are on such a roll at the moment that do people want to step back, or are people happy going to every race because they want to be part of it? They want to live this experience?
I think we let people make their own decisions. Good collaboration between an employee and their manager to understand what makes them tick. There are many people in the team that do all races. There are some that want one off, some that want a few off. And we just encourage that to be the right answer for them and the right answer for the team.
Is the TPC program under the cost cap, or is it outside?
So the TPC and heritage function is outside of the cost cap. And in the current rules, you're allowed to use some apportionment of time to help inside the cap. So that community is timesheeted, and we're regularly audited to ensure that we are balancing how that apportionment works.
This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low-impact motion. And I don't need to second-guess my progress because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID. There's more to come from Piers shortly. And once our chat's finished, why not check out F1's other official podcasts? F1 Nation's review of the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix is out now. Lando Norris joins us and is incredibly honest as he explains how the pressure he puts on himself to be perfect is leading to mistakes. That's available on your podcast app now. And this week's episode of F1 Explains is with Alpine's Oliver Oakes. That's out on Friday. Can we talk a little bit more about the cost cap now? Maybe wind the clock back, first of all, to when you first joined the team back in 2008. It was a bit of a free-for-all, wasn't it? It was an arms race. There was no limit on what a team could spend. You spent as much as you got in. I mean, can you give us an idea of just how crazy those times were?
Pre-cost cap, certainly you're right in kind of describing it like an arms race. But certainly I would also describe it as lacking in efficiency and focus. And the level of joined upness that we now have means that we are efficient and effective. It's one of the things that is actually quite an exciting technical challenge of what's the right model to operate under the cap, blending how you apportion between your spend on the car and labour, blending your quantities to be extremely joined up, to have just enough at the track and at the factory, and never ever making something to just put it on the shelf, because there's no performance for anything that's just sat on the shelf, and being extremely joined up to know when the next project is coming that's weight reducing or aerodynamic performance, to then harvest that and put that onto the car. So you've got to have quite a simple and effective system with extremely competent and joined up people to understand all of that. And what's great is we've got a very, very simple and agile model about how we look at that.
Under the cost cap, do you feel you've optimized these regulations? Or imagine there was no cost cap now. Would the current car be faster?
Obviously, the regulations dictate a huge amount of wind tunnel time. And other commercial factors that mean you can run and you are trading between certain things at certain times. So yes, if none of it was there, you'd be back into the arms race that was the past. But what we are able to do is, under the cost cap, is be creative and targeted in our decision making. And that means we focus on the right level of performance and the right quantity of parts.
Can you put some numbers on that? So like, how many front wings are you producing in 2024, 2025 versus 10 years ago? How many different iterations?
So a component like a front wing will evolve in the year. Sometimes it's a completely direct replacement. Sometimes it evolves with things being bonded and unbonded from it. So it's quite difficult to answer your question. In terms of stock, a front wing is quite an exposed assembly. Formula One racing is very, very close. And occasionally you do suffer damage. So we would always stock here 5, occasionally 6 front wings. But we'd always have parts live in manufacture so that, for example, in a triple header, you've got to think, what if you lose one or two in the first one and the second one and the third one that you're never exposed? So we were always trading risk, manufacturing, stock and quantities to make sure we make decisions on an extremely frequent basis.
One of the things the team has done is using recycled carbon as part of the racing car. What does that mean and how do you achieve that?
I think everybody in the world has got to be comfortable to talk about sustainability. The sustainability of what we produce and how we run the team is very much on our agenda. And we, not only in the composite world, have looked at how we can use recycled carbon just to provoke and tell the story of how that could be embedded as part of the regulations in the future. And we've done a number of projects that have put that front and center to ignite that discussion. Also, our waste streams in our metallic manufacturing world are very, very organized and segregated to ensure that clean waste that can be recycled where possible is always the route that we now take. And what's great is, again, like the continuous improvement projects from the MRC community, many of our sustainability threads and ideas come from good conversations from our members of staff, and we really, really encourage that. But certainly there's more to do on that front for us and for everybody, but we're very much on that journey.
So looking at the factory as a whole now, do you feel that you have everything you need now? You've got the new wind tunnel, the simulators bang on, you've got your new composites just down the road. Is McLaren Racing exactly where it needs to be, or have you still got ideas where you think you need to improve?
I think I'm pleased with where we are, but the journey never stops. The journey of continuous improvement in process, kit, equipment, infrastructure, communications will never stop. It's always important that wherever we are, we're always pushing the boundaries. Raising the bar is part of this sport, whether you're at the track or in the factory. And if you're not doing that, you're not going to be moving forward and you'll find yourself falling back. So we challenge ourselves each and every day to make sure we are never resting on our laurels. We're humble, never complacent, but always asking what the next step can be.
Now, you've talked about the size and scale of everything in Woking. Two people we haven't spoken about are the drivers. How integral are they to what goes on back at the MTC? How much do people look up to them? How much do you even see them back at home?
So we see the drivers regularly. They're in for engineering and commercial tasks, often between races. We're very, very lucky to have two grounded individuals who do talk to people, engage with the team at all levels. And that's really, really important. We're lucky that we've got two drivers who are extremely competent. They're aggressive and take risks and are delivering and scoring points on a regular basis. And extremely lucky that we've got them secured into the future.
Piers, you've worked with a lot of what I call the modern day greats since you've been at McLaren. I'm thinking of Lewis Hamilton, Jenson Button, Fernando Alonso. Have you seen enough from Lando and Oscar to put them in the same bracket as those guys I've just mentioned?
I think they are on slightly different trajectories. Lando's a little bit further on in his career than Oscar is. But they both have absolutely all of the qualities that are needed to win races and world championships. And the team is just laser focused on ensuring that we deliver the right infrastructure, kit and equipment and strategy for them to do that 24 times a year.
And how different do you think the drivers of today are to, I don't know how much contact you had with Nigel Mansell, for example, but is the beast still the same, or is the job of a Formula One driver today very different to 30 years ago?
I think the product in which they drive is quite different. I think the level of bespokeness and keeping a car in the window is extremely tight now. The level of complexity of driving a car has definitely increased. And I think that's why we see the younger community evolving from sim racing and very easily adapting to running in a Formula One car. And that's why you see many of the top drivers often are using that as a development tool to help them grow. I think the intensity of the amount of races is quite different. And that's why we are extremely supportive of how we manage time, because the balance between all the activities that they need to do can be quite overwhelming. And we try to make sure we strike that balance to support them in every way that we can to be focused commercially and, more importantly, on the performance side and get that balance right.
Piers, what a brilliant chat. I've absolutely loved this. Thank you so much for your time. If you were to sum up the last 17 years of your life, what has been the biggest difference in Formula One 2008 versus 2025?
I think the reason why I love working in Formula One is just it grows in complexity and challenge each and every day. And I think the move from V8s into the hybrid era was a fantastic challenge. And that felt insurmountable at times, but you just kind of get through it. The quantity of races has grown. The complexity of the manufacturing, the packaging on the car has just taken steps. And I just relish those challenges each and every day.
You found your sweet spot. Piers, thank you very much for your time. One final thing before I go. Formula One is 75 years old in 2025. Do you have a favourite memory, a favourite Formula One memory from that time?
My earliest fantastic memory from my childhood would be the British Grand Prix in 1992. Extremely special. And obviously I had a huge amount of DNA linked at that time. So that's probably a highlight for me. But personally, from a work-based journey, the commitment and resilience to continue to add performance to the car that we did as a team last year, and the excitement that played out in the race at Abu Dhabi at the last event last year was also an extremely exciting and highlight for me.
Piers, thank you very much for your time. Great to chat.
Thank you.
I'm sure no one at McLaren will forget Abu Dhabi 2024 anytime soon. The release of tension in the garage was almost audible at the end of the race. It was a truly special moment for the team. And I think Piers was a truly special guest. He gave us a wonderful insight into the complexities of running an F1 factory, emphasising just how much of the race is back at base and not trackside. And while Piers is clearly process-driven, he lacks nothing for passion, as proven by his descriptions of the heritage cars and his own hill-climbing prowess. Piers, many thanks for your time and good luck for the remainder of the season. Well, that's it from me for now. Many thanks for listening, and I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.